Hello and welcome to Databook, a Chief Healthcare Executive podcast. My name is Samara Rosenfeld, and today we are joined via Zoom by Dwayne Schilke, Executive Director of the Alliance for Integrated Care of New York, LLC. Schilke also serves as the Executive Vice President of Health Management Initiatives at Cerebral Palsy Associations of New York State. On this episode, we discuss health data, innovations, and more. Thank you so much, Dwayne, for joining us today. Can you start by telling the audience about yourself and your position?
Yes, I'm the Executive Director of a Medicare Shared Savings Program, ACO, called the Alliance for Integrated Care of New York. I've been working in the intellectual and developmental disabilities field since 1973. All that time with the Cerebral Palsy Association. Currently, I'm Executive Vice President for Health Management Initiatives of Cerebral Palsy Associations of New York State. So I wear a few hats.
COVID-19 has devastated healthcare services to at-risk populations. Why is that?
Well, in our case, we were stay-at-home orders were imposed on all people with intellectual and developmental disabilities in New York State. So no one was able to go to medical visits unless they were emergency. And if you saw the news during COVID, going to the emergency room in New York City during the peak about a year ago was not something to do. And you probably couldn't get in unless you were very, very ill. They basically were turning people away at the emergency rooms. So when we look at our data, we see that our graphs on spending zeroed out starting March 4th or whenever the COVID emergency was imposed in New York. There was no visits. So we went into a panic, except we had a relief because we had started to install a statewide telemedicine project that we had been piloting in New York City. The telemedicine project allowed us to do video telemedicine with kiosks in all of the patients' homes. So that they're, because people are disabled, they typically need assistance with their medical visits. So the caretakers, staff that know the folks well in their homes were able to assist them with connecting to a 24/7 telemedicine system that allowed us to fill all those gaps and provide services. We didn't bill for any of it because it was done through a grant. We got a $10.2 million grant from New York State to roll out telemedicine across the state to 7,000 people over the course of 5 years. So that was a godsend, and it literally saved lives. But virtually all routine medical visits stopped instantly and stayed stopped for several months. So we had to deal with what are the most, on a triage basis, what are the most important matters that need to get in front of a doctor as soon as possible to avoid people's conditions deteriorating. And we were very successful at it. We saved lives with this initiative. So our COVID was very unique because of having that project at hand. And we did fairly well with it, and we stayed booted up. So even after COVID started to mellow out a little bit, we stayed with telemedicine visits and almost all of our mental health and psychiatry visits, which are a lot, because of the coexistence of mental health conditions and behavioral conditions of the patients, continue and will probably continue onward. So we were able to do med renewals, which is what's critically important with people with mental health conditions. The only thing we weren't able to do was do labs, which is important with managing certain mental health medications. So we did some things with a lab company we're working with, LabCorp, other patients, arrangements that they had where they were going to the homes and taking blood draws at the people's houses so they didn't have to travel because they couldn't. Routine medical continued with primary care. The things that really fell out and are still a problem are just really now getting back up to gear are podiatry, dental, gynecology, things that really, for the most part, need a face-to-face visit that really can't be accomplished with a telemedicine visit. So we've now been relieved of the stay-at-home orders, and people can now start to venture out for those specialty services. And we have a lot of catch-up to do. So I think the message is someone really, it's a whole different routine than we're used to. Someone has to go back and scrub charts and see who missed colonoscopies, who missed mammograms, who missed other visits that are routine, you know, standard evidence-based practice-driven treatment to find out what's missing. And we're using the tool that we got from Health EC to help us do that. So we can run metrics on individual patients and point out to you which things are outstanding. The mammogram that wasn't, that's due and wasn't done is kind of sticking out there. And someone has to explore, did it really happen and just to not get recorded properly? You know, data management is extremely difficult because of coding. So we do the best we can, and it is a new open book for us in terms of how we have learned how to manage people's care with data that comes from claims. Prior to becoming an ACO, we only had our treatment data. And, you know, a lot of that isn't hard-coded, so you can't run population health metrics to find out what evidence-based practices are outstanding if things weren't coded properly. And that's not something you can fix because a lot of it is outside providers, and we gather the information through a RIO so we can download that data into patients' records. But it's, you know, PDFs, so it's not functional data, and you can't use it that way. So there's a huge gap that still exists with exchanging information between systems that it doesn't have the right specificity. We're getting there and we're doing better. But, you know, from the perspective of managing people's care as a healthcare executive, that's very troubling. And we spend a lot of work trying to make workarounds to create data that we can use better than we have in the past. But having claims data is the world. From a healthcare executive's point of view, if you don't have claims data, I challenge you to manage people's care properly if they have community-based providers. That's kind of like the lesson learned and the challenge that we face on an ongoing basis, and one that that we spend a lot of effort trying to make workarounds.
So how much of a role does interoperability play?
We make tremendous progress, but there's with a long ways to go. It has many fronts on it. I just spoke about a few of them. So we have actually created bridges in some cases between our population health management program that Health EC provides and the EHRs themselves, so that we have exchanges of information that go back and forth. For example, once a week in one practice in the city, which I'm the closest with, all the data that is changed is downloaded into Health EC from the EHR. Health EC can communicate with the with the providers associated with the EHR, with pre-visit summaries and all the documents the doctor would need to know in advance of a visit to be able to have a good visit, the medication administration record. No matter what anybody tells you, the medication record in the EHR is not the Bible. You don't see other physicians' stop orders. If you and I get an order from our doctor to stop taking a medication, we stop taking the medication and we don't reorder a refill. Well, the EHR says Johnny's still taking metformin. The doctor may have stopped it, but you don't know that. So the administration record that comes with the person from the place where they live, plus things like bowel movement charts, blood pressure charts, menses charts, whatever the doctor is ordering to be monitored on an ongoing basis, is able to be communicated from the home to the physician in the clinic, which is part of the ACO, which is following up on evidence-based practices, and whatever medical issues the person presents for the visit. We found all that essential. That's real interoperability. Then the real that someone can consent to have all of their medical visit information shared with their primary care doctor. So what we get is this flood. I'm talking flood of so much information in PDF format that's useless that we can't even manage it. So we ignore it because we can't deal with it. We'd have to have a full-time staff person just sitting there opening these web-based Rio interfaces. You know, unfortunately, people that design these things are not people that work in practices. So they created something, spent gazillions of dollars. It's statewide. There's a statewide organization that supports it. So it's like, oh, that was great. We had no information. And now we have so much that we can't even decipher it. And then when we do open it, what good is it? It's a PDF. So there's been some failures. I'm talking about massive failures of millions and millions of dollars spent to create something. I don't know. You know, Marcus Welby might have been okay with it, sitting reading notes all day. We're too busy. We can't manage it. So interoperability is a two-edged sword. And frankly, the people driving the bus don't have a map. I don't know how else to say it. So we do it because you got to do it, but we do it as functionally as we can. And it really is a huge development project to create interoperability with all nine practices. We would also like interoperability for GPRO purposes, because as an ACO, we report GPRO. We're in the middle of it right now, reporting our GPRO PQRS measures to CMS, which we have to do once a year. And we have a portal provided by the vendor, HealthyC. Each practice gets its list provided by CMS, opens records and answers the questions that CMS presented. And then that portal gets uploaded to CMS's site in total for the whole ACO. So interoperability is a complex issue that is being pressed further and further by CMS. It's hard to not open up emails on a day and not find some interoperability messages, either from vendors. AI is starting to squeeze its way into this world. And I think it will be extraordinarily helpful eventually. But right now they're just, you know, kind of dipping in the bucket, thinking that they know they can help us. But again, you know, it'll be a while before those relationships mature enough so that we can use AI in a more practical way. Like, go read those PDFs and convert the words that we need to codes so it's actionable. That's a possibility. And there's others too. HCC coding, could sweep, you could have an AI sweep of a group of health records and find out where doctors have written things that could have been coded in an HCC manner that would have credited that visit with more complexity and eventually, hopefully, some reimbursement. And I guess the backdrop of all this is really value-based purchasing by payers. The ACO has given us a tremendous opportunity to dip our toes in the water and learn what it means to work in value-based payments. For example, I can tell you, in our last round of financial results, which was 2019, we don't know 2020 until this fall, but in 2019, we're 92.17%. Now, the result of that is that we got a 46.1% savings on the amount of money we saved the payer instead of 50%. So quality matters in this case tremendously. So it's point for point. If that was 91% we would have got a half a point less shared savings. So, you know, as rudimentary as it is, it works. And we can see that if you provide good quality services, that it will reduce expenses as long as you have good analysis of spending. And that's kind of like the three-legged stool. And we've proven that that works. So we focus mainly on improving the quality on a patient-by-patient basis. Data lets you hotspot. Where are the places in this forest? If I keep looking at the forest, I'm never going to find the five people with diabetes not controlled with A1Cs under 7. So if I run diabetes reports, I'll find those seven people and I'll be able to hotspot and look at what's going on with their situation that causes them to not be able to be controlled properly. Non-compliance with meds, non-compliance with dietary orders, whatever it is, do an intervention and you can make a difference. So we've learned a tremendous amount in the 3 years we've been working with, well, it's actually 5 years now, with HealthEC. We had a savings every year from 2017, 18, and 19, which was our last performance period with the ACO, which runs in three-year cycles. The challenge before us is in 2022, we have to assume downside risk. Our history says that we're good at this and the risk is small and we'll be able to get a reinsurance package, a surety bond to cover our downside risk, which will be determined by CMS. So we don't get to decide how much that should be. We pick a track, they put us in a track, they run the numbers, they run benchmark numbers, and then they tell us, well, here's potentially what your loss will be. And this is the amount you have to cover in case that occurs. Because they put limits on gains and losses depending upon what kind of an ACO you are. Our nature is to be conservative. So we'll take the lowest risk for downside, but that will also contain the amount of savings we can receive. But we're willing to trade that off until we get a little more confidence in knowing that we can manage this effectively over time. My concern is once you've taken the waste out of the system, how do you keep doing that? So we had some low-hanging fruit. Emergency rooms and associated hospitalizations were our biggest cost. Our 24/7 triage has virtually eliminated that so that only 17% of our calls for triage end up in a transfer. It used to be 75% when we did it ourselves. So we had family practice doctors doing after-hours coverage with no tools, and the only access they had was the EHR. With video telemedicine, with a Bluetooth stethoscope that also does a heart strip, we've reduced that to 17%, which is really where all our savings has come from. And we'll continue to do that. So we've got 4 more years on the grant that allows us the luxury of having that service available and paid for, so we don't have to dig deep in our pockets. It's probably cost about $20 PMPM per person to maintain the scope of the telemedicine project. But it's been extraordinarily successful. Requires a lot of maintenance, a lot of training of staff. There's a tremendous amount of turnover of caregivers with people with intellectual and developmental disability. So you as the health provider have to be able to step up and continually train the turned over staff, which is about 40% turnover. So it's enormous. Every time you walk in a house, 40% of the staff since a month ago are new and need to be trained. And we see it in the data. We start to dig in and say, why is that house using the service less? And then we go look and, oh, nobody trains the staff. Well, we did train them twice already. Well, you got to do it again. So some of the new tools have amazing outcomes, but they have a cost of operations and maintenance, which has really not been accommodated by the system. So I guess from a healthcare executive point of view, I'm willing to invest things if I know there's going to be an outcome. But if I don't have that money. We're all nonprofits. We barely make enough money to keep the lights on. We're not about to invest. We don't have the refund, the resources to invest in enterprise-wise initiatives like chronic care management, since we're talking about a Medicare population. Chronic care management, along with those quality improvements, are the two things coupled together that make a difference in patients' lives. So you need to somehow predict what's going to be beneficial before you invest in it, because we don't have money to play around, you know, do things that look good but have no proven basis.
How can other healthcare executives leverage technology and data to improve outcomes, such as how you're using Health EC's platform?
I believe that if they're in a cost-sharing arrangement, that the proof is in the pudding. It will pay for itself. Telemedicine will be a worthy investment. Developing the platform and vehicle for the kinds of patients you're serving is not that complex. It can go down to a smartphone. We found money out there available to give people tablets. If you can give people iPads, you know, through a grant, or even buy them, they're not that expensive. So if I was an enterprise that was a for-profit enterprise, I would make the investment now because I know it will pay for itself. So I think just a cost analysis and a would show people that it's beneficial.
What is the importance of population health management?
It lets you see the trees in the forest. It lets you, if you try to look at 7,000 patients all at once, you can do some nice bar graphs and you can look at the trends across the whole population and focus on things from a dashboard point of view, like what are the highest spending categories? Go look at those in more detail now drill down into patients and look and identify who are the patients that are driving it. Typically, what you find is there's a 20 to 25% group of patients that drive the high cost areas. But who are they so that you can do something about it? That's where population health management comes in. It lets you identify the individuals who are high utilizers. And you may say when it's done, oh, that's good. So that person's high utilizers, utilization of a certain specialty may be actually maintaining their cost over time rather than let it continue to go up by controlling a condition that the person has that needs attention. So that's kind of like the hot spotting approach. Who are the high utilizers? Do an analysis of those individual patients, present it to the practice, let them develop an intervention to address it, and then look for the outcomes.
Is there anything else you would like to add about how AICNY is leveraging technology and data from HealthEC or anything else?
We are constantly improving our utilization of the HealthEC tool. So we are stepping up educational sessions so that people at the practice level can do more inquiry themselves. They don't need to rely on us and my meager staff of three to feed them the information in a spoonful. They need to kind of develop the ability and capacity to use the tool themselves when they look at their own dashboard and they see that something is extraordinarily high cost compared to the rest of the practices, shows you where you stick out. And maybe it's okay, but you won't know it's okay until you look at it and do some analysis. So I really think the benefits of a tool like HealthEC is not just looking at the whole of it, all nine practices together, but it's really each practice developing their capacity to use the tool better themselves.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Okay, you're welcome. Anytime.
Thank you so much for tuning in to this week's episode of Databook. Make sure you follow us on Twitter at Chief Health Exec and on LinkedIn and Facebook. Until next time, I'm your host, Samara Rosenfeld.